and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Broderick. Today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically we're going to be looking into protecting privacy. And this is a pretty large topic, and it deals with a lot of different things. Some of them might be more obvious to you, like, you know, maybe you're thinking about end user privacy, but we've also got to consider, you know, data and for our corporation and keeping that private. And here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How are you doing today, Adam?
I'm doing well. So let's talk about privacy a little bit, right? Let's think about privacy. And we've spoken about privacy already. We've spoken a lot about what privacy means from the individual's perspective. Think about what we talk about as PII, P-I-I. Personally identifiable information is what PII represents, or what is meant by PII. And when we think about personally identifiable information, we're thinking about data that is unique to an individual. So a driver's license number uniquely identifies me. The United States, a social security number, a passport number. There may be many different things that identify an individual. Maybe their medical records, perhaps an employee ID within a either a ERP system or a customer ID in a CRM system, customer relationship management, enterprise resource provisioning is what ERP stands for, right? So the idea generically is, how do we take all that unique data and not just manage it, not just use it, but how do we safeguard it? How do we apply confidentiality, integrity at a minimum, and certainly availability standards to it to safeguard that data? And this is really what protecting privacy and privacy thought processes have to be about today. It's about all the things that can go wrong with data, exposing it unnecessarily, that we really are attempting to discuss and think through. So individuals, right, starting from this thought process or this particular point, individuals should be given the right to control their own data. We can probably all agree that whether or not in law that is stipulated, it's a good idea, right? And so although we struggle with it, for instance, here in the United States, it is not something that is enshrined in law the way it is in the European Union. But we still have a thought process that individuals should have control over their own data. The problem is we don't back it up with as many laws and protections as they do in other countries. So we still think that that's important, but we haven't acted necessarily in the same forthright manner. Having said that, though, as a CISSP, working inside of a company, being in charge of or ultimately being focused on data privacy, you still have to come up with policies, you still have to implement procedures ultimately, and you still have to manage data access and data security. Whether or not it's the law of the land that individuals should have ultimate control of their data, you have to decide what data control means within the boundary of the organization. And what we have to really then struggle with is, what does that boundary mean, right? We've talked about data classification and data not only classification, but categorization in terms of what data is and what it means to the organization to have that data. We've spoken about this and talked about this in a prior episode. What we have to do is take that thought process, link that to the geographical conversation about what the boundary or border of the information is going to be. Is it just literally within our organization? Is it being shared with other partners, other vendors inside of our supply chain, up and down and throughout that chain? And if it is, does the border now really extend to them? And then what if they turn around and share that with one of their subcontracted relationships? How far down the level, or how far down rather, that level do we go, or that particular rat hole or black hole, or not rat hole, black hole, rabbit hole, that's the one I was trying to come up with. How far down that hole do we actually go in order to track our data? You know, this is a very complicated decision point for us as security professionals, because if we want to extend the border of the data and therefore the protection of the data to individuals outside the immediate organization, we have to come up with ways to ensure that they're going to manage the data the same way that we want the data to be secured. And if they're not going to do that, we probably shouldn't share the data with them. That's just the reality. So, you know, how secure is the data? How accessible is the data? Under what format will the data be used? In what shape and form will the data be used? Will it be stored? Will it be transferred? You know, these are questions that really can complicate our lives dramatically when we think about data protection. The EU, the European Union, as I've talked about in some of our prior discussions, has really taken the lead on this. They have, through their Data Protection Directive 9546, really stood out in front of everybody else and said, this is how we view the data protection rights of the individual and the rights of the individual to manage their data throughout the data life cycle. So strengthening individuals' rights is really what the focus of that directive has been, and being able to give users, individual users, the rights to control the disposition of their data is what the ultimate goal of that directive has been. So we want to be thinking about that, understanding that, ensuring that we have a sense of that. Obviously, along with that, we then have to think about, as I was just saying, how we extend the border of that protection out beyond the EU. So we talk about a concept known as the safe harbor provisions. Whether we get into the conversation specifically about what safe harbor permissions or protections exist currently today, and they are in flux, as I've mentioned in one of our prior conversations. The idea of safe harbor right now is being reevaluated, which means that although we have the generic concept of safe harbor, we should understand generically what that means, the specificity of how it's being implemented may change over time. And so let's focus more broadly, just generally, the idea of what a safe harbor provision looks like, not the specificity of what one may or may not be in any moment in time. And the idea of a safe harbor provision effectively helps us as a company that is looking to do business with individuals and secure and safeguard their data to understand what the requirements are for us to align with in order to secure and to do exactly that, safeguard their data in alignment with whatever the national legislative requirements may be. So in just plain English, we have to effectively use safe harbor provisions to give us the rule book, the playbook that we should manage the data through in order to be aligned with the requirements of the country that has said, this is what our laws are. So in the example of the EU Data Protection Directive, the 9546 Directive, the United States and other entities that want to do business with the European Union, and subjects that are going to live in the EU, individuals that are there that want to provide their data to some sort of a business so that they can buy something, right? Or maybe a doctor or a hospital concern or a healthcare concern that may expose their data outside of the border of the EU in order to work with a partner, something like that. If they're doing that, that data is not subject necessarily to EU data protection laws. Some countries may not recognize those laws and as a result may say, well, that's nice, but we have our own laws. We're going to protect the data based on what we say. What safe harbor effectively says to those countries is, if you want access to the data, you're going to have to abide by the boiled down version of the EU data protection laws that are stipulated in the safe harbor agreement that we negotiate between the country that wants the data and wants the business and, in this case, the EU. And having done that, it gives us a playbook, a rule book that says these are the basic tenets you have to follow. You have to implement these basic protections. You have to help us to manage your data this way. Although you may not follow the exact letter of the law using safe harbor, you will follow the spirit of the law. And by following the spirit of the law, you are aligned enough. You are providing enough protection that we will say that it's okay for you to manage the data on our behalf. This is effectively what safe harbor provides. So whether it is a safe harbor agreement between the United States, hypothetically, and the EU, whether it is a safe harbor agreement between the United States and another country, whatever it may be, it doesn't really matter. Two countries that are just simply looking to exchange information where both countries have very clear legislative requirements that are different, a safe harbor agreement can bridge the gap and allow the two countries to effectively manage data effectively. That's what a safe harbor requirement will do. So I just want to be thinking about that, be aware of that as part of our conversation. When we think about, and we've already talked about data information from the perspective of ownership, we know that the data owner should help us to classify data and should stipulate how data will be classified. Remember that data ownership is really about understanding who is ultimately responsible for data. When I own data, it's mine, in effect. If I own it, I can decide what will be done with it. I could decide how long it will stick around. I could decide who should have access to it. I could decide if it should be destroyed and when. So I want to be thinking about the fact that ownership implies control, right? This is a very important thought process for me. It's an important thought process for you. When you think about becoming a CISSP, we focus a lot on data management. We focus a lot on data ownership, data accountability in terms of who's going to be accountable and responsible for data. And we talk about access control systems that help us to do this, things like discretionary access control, mandatory access control, attribute-based access control, temporal-based access control, rule-based access control, role-based access control. Stop me when you hear one that you may like, right? Any or all of these, and there are more, by the way. And we'll talk about all of those at some point in one of our episodes together, and you'll hear us go through and explain what they are. But the idea is that there are many access control models. They are used, regardless of how they're set up to operate, to implement control of data and control of the users that are accessing data. We talk about subjects and objects in those models. Subjects are going to be the users, and then objects are going to represent the data. And so subjects want access to objects, and objects have to effectively allow themselves to be accessed by authenticating users into the system. And so we talk more about how all that works, but information ownership and data ownership is a very big part of that. We have to understand who owns the data and effectively based on that, what they decide the data will or will not be allowed to be able to be used as or used for or seen by. And those kind of questions come up with regards to ownership. Determining the impact the information has on the organization, in other words, is a function of ownership. Understanding the replacement cost of the information is a function of ownership. Determining who has a need to see the data and under what circumstances, these are all functions of ownership. These are things that data ownership implies that we would be doing. So I want to just make sure we're aware of that and we understand that as part of the discussion. We've talked a lot about documentation and why documentation is so important. Every time we do something, we should have a written record of what it is. We talk a lot in the discussions about intrusion detection and intrusion prevention systems and firewalls about the value of logging and writing everything down in a log so we know what's been happening. We talk a lot in our discussions with databases about transactional logging so we understand what's happening and writing down all the transactions so we see them and can reproduce them if we need to. Everywhere we go, everywhere we look, everywhere we turn, we see a discussion about documentation cropping up with regards to system management. It's very, very important. So generically, the idea for CISSP, and for that matter, for any IT professional, not just a security-focused one, but any IT professional, is the more documentation we have, the better we are, right? And we can never have too much, as we know, because when we ask people on average, hey, do you think your documentation is really good? What we often hear from them is, it's okay, but it could be better, right? Could always do a better job. If I had more time, right? Everybody's always whining about time. If I just had more time. If you didn't start if you stopped complaining so much and started doing your job, you have a lot more time, right? So the idea is that when we do, and all kidding aside, right, we clearly can do a better job if we spend more time doing things. There's no doubt about that. But the balance and the problem is, you know, we only have so many hours to do our job in a day, and we only have so many things that we can get done. And usually documentation, although it's very important, is further down the list of things that we need to get to. But sometimes, and more often than not, let's be honest, usually don't have the time to get to, right? That's usually the rub, and that's the problem. So while documentation is very important, data ownership implies the documentation about the data should be kept up to date as well. And so data owners have a responsibility to make sure documentation about the data is kept up to date. That's one of the few things that data ownership really demands of the owner, is that documentation about the data is kept up to date. So ownership of the data in terms of things like copywriting, getting a patent, perhaps a trademark, we've spoken about those. Those are things the data owner would probably be involved in trying to do because they're part of the responsibility of ownership. Making sure not that we actually pull the levers to create backups of our data, but that we have a thought process in the organization, we have policies and we have procedures that stipulate that our data will be backed up and we will have copies of it in case there's a disaster and a plan to recover it. That's part of data ownership. That's part of the responsibility as well. So these are all things we want to be thinking about. We want to juxtapose, we want to compare data ownership with something known as data custodianship. A little bit of a different thought process. Formal term, what custodianship really means is that we are going to be the caretakers of the data on a day-to-day operational basis. Ownership implies overarching accountability and responsibility for the systems around the management of that data and the classification of it to ensure that the data is going to be used in the appropriate ways. Custodianship is the implementation of those controls and the management of data within those systems, moment to moment, day to day, you know, day in, day out kind of thing. So custodianship's about the actual tactical management of data, whereas ownership is about the strategic operationalizing or setting up and therefore envisioning of how data will be used. We want to make a clear distinction between these two roles. They both are very important and they both exist in the organization, but we don't always clearly define them. A lot of times we'll just simply say, oh, yeah, you're the data owner. Mike, you created that document. Mike, who's going to see that document? And Mike says, well, Mike is going to see it, so I'm going to see it, right? Adam's going to see it, and Joe's going to see it. Anybody else, Mike? No, nobody else. Great. Mike, thank you. And then that's all we do. And then somebody goes off and implements Mike's access control request, or maybe Mike implements it himself. If he's the data owner but also happens to be able to do that, he may just say, I'll just go ahead and make the appropriate changes on the access control list and we're done because I own the data. No big deal. But what we're really doing is we're asking Mike to play the role of data owner. And then we're asking Mike to tell the data custodian how Mike wants to implement the ownership responsibilities that he's been given. So this is a very big, important distinction for us that we want to make sure we draw. So when we assign the role of data custodianship, we have to be clear. We have to be unequivocal about who will inhabit that role. In most organizations, IT administrators are going to be the data custodians. But we want to keep in mind that custodianship may be implied in the access control model. In other words, a mandatory access control model, while it is maintained by IT administrators, actually implements moment-to-moment ownership and management of the data once the data is put into the system, because the mandatory access control model implies data sensitivity and user labeling. Both the object and the subject have to be labeled, and they have to be at the same level in order to effectively be able to see each other, or the user has to be at a minimum, let's say, at the level of the data. They may be above the data, but they have to be at least at the minimum level of the data in order for the two to correspond. So if we have a three-tiered system, hypothetically, level one being the lowest, level two being the middle, level three being the highest, if a user's labeled at level one or given level one access, and data exists at level one, they're both at the same level. In a mandatory model, they can see each other. And as a result, user and data can interact. The mandatory access control model is implementing that. It's acting as the custodian of the data once the system is set up, is what I'm trying to point out to you. Right? While there is an oversight role, there is a management role outside of the system, the actual implementation of the controls is being done through the system itself. If I was a level two user and data was at level one, I would still be able to see the data. But if we invert that, if data is at level two and the user is at level one, user doesn't see the data in a mandatory system. So we want to make sure we understand that data custodianship has to be assigned as a role, but that role may then actually be implemented through an access control mechanism of some kind. And we want to just be aware of that and kind of keep that in the back of our minds as well. When we think about data and we think about data use, and we think about how data can be implemented for use, we also want to think about the quality of data, right? Is data good? How do we know? Remember, integrity is a very important part of the conversation around information security management. If we don't have integrity, we may not have data that's good. And if we don't have data that's good, the use of that data may be flawed or compromised. So we have to think about data quality as well as data management and data usage. This is another important aspect of data. And when we think about privacy and privacy protection, we're thinking about the quality of the data as well as the data itself. Data quality standards would involve a variety of things, things like accuracy, things like reliability, things like repeatability, reproducibility. The data itself should be relevant to the organization. So these kind of things have to be looked at and examined when we think about data quality. Is the data timely? Is it complete? These are all things that we would want to know and be aware of. We often talk about quality control versus quality assurance, QA versus QC, as two ways of thinking about quality. Quality control is really an assessment of the quality based on internal standards and processes that monitor the quality of the data and the system, but from an internal perspective. Quality assurance is an assessment of quality based on standards, typically external to the organization or the process. So QC is really an internal look at the quality of the data, assessing the data and monitoring it. QA is typically thought of as an external look at the data from a quality and a standards perspective. Just want to differentiate between the two and make sure we're comfortable with those or both of those thought processes as well. When we assess data quality, we also have to think about verifying the integrity of the data. And I made that point earlier. I just want to remind you of that. It's not just about, hey, from a QA perspective, the data looks good. We have to verify the data still has integrity and indeed still has value. And this is also a very important thought process for us to engage in as well. We've talked about the value of documentation. We've talked about being able to lay out classification and qualification of the data. These things are all done based on data standards. And the organization should typically create some sort of a data standard that is going to lay out for us as security professionals, for the information workers in the system, for the information owners, for the data custodians, what the expectation of data management will look like. And data standards describe the objects, the features, or items that are collected about data, and how data will then be used is really what a data standard stipulates. So we want to make sure we are aware of that and we think about that. You know, the benefits of data standards are better data management overall, increased data sharing, typically higher quality of data will be found, improved consistency and integration of the data will come from a standard. These are all things that are important. You know, if you have never been involved in drafting a data standard, and let's be honest, most of us, unless you do this specifically, may never have done this or even thought about it. It may not be something you're just really sure how to do. It could be kind of hard, a little bit daunting, right? There is guidance out there. You can, of course, go out and look for sample standards, right? We've talked about policies. In fact, you can find policies online. You can find sample data standards online as well. You can talk to peers and colleagues. I've talked a lot about the value of networking with organizations that will help you to build your information security career over time. And talking to peers and colleagues that do these kind of things that may have a background with this is another way for you to be able to get some insight into drafting data standards. But if all else fails, right, go to the Oracle of the Internet, as we often say. Go to Google, right? And Google. And if you Google for data standards, you will find a wealth of information about what standards exist, which ones you may want to find and therefore perhaps co-opt and use, would then be a question for you to consider ultimately. Right, we also have to think about the legal implications of data management when it comes to privacy. We've talked about the EU Privacy Protection Directive. There are international typically, there may be national, there may be regional and local laws, standards, guidelines, things that we have to be aware of. There could be in the United States, for instance, federal laws that stipulate how data has to be managed. Things like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, for instance, right, will stipulate how credit information is supposed to be reported and managed for individuals. But then there may be state-based laws that in some cases may have a different take or interpretation on things. More often than not, the federal law may be the law that we follow because it is the overarching law in the United States, but that doesn't always mean that the state law can be ignored. The state law may take precedence. It really depends on what we're talking about. And so we really have to be aware of the fact that as a security professional, there may be more than one set of regulations and requirements we have to abide by. There could be local laws within the city or the municipality or the county or wherever you may find yourself that you have to abide by as a business owner. And you may have to follow those along with the state laws and the federal laws and the international laws and, you know, all of those things, right? So, you know, we have to think about the multi-layer complexity of jurisdiction when it comes to this kind of thing. And you'll walk through in our head what that may mean ultimately. And what that could mean is that it could be very complicated to manage something. That's really what it could mean ultimately. We have to think about the data life cycle. We've talked a lot about life cycles and why they're important. We've talked about the idea of requirements gathering up front, thinking about how to acquire and implement, thinking about how to operate and maintain, and ultimately how to decommission and dispose. These are the standard forms or the standard phases of a life cycle. We want to make sure we understand what those are and why they're important. We've talked a lot about them already. We also want to think about data modeling a little bit when we think about privacy and the use of data. You know, how do we create databases and how do we put data into storage facilities that can then be pulled out, reported on, and used? And data modeling helps us to do this. It helps us to examine the data, helps us to understand the value of the data through reporting, through what more often than not today is referred to as either BI, business intelligence, or big data analytics. These are terms we often hear and we often hear a lot about. When we examine data and we want to be able to use it, we want to extract value out of it in effect, right? We want to be able to take a spreadsheet that has a bunch of information on it, and we want to then be able to read that information and in innovative ways, examine the value of the data and extract it so we can use it. Maybe it's a spreadsheet that has a bunch of sales figures in it, and we want to be able to see what the cumulative sales were for that particular time period. That's pretty straightforward. That's just a quick calculation. But what about trending in that data? Did the sales go up or down? Day by day, week by week, month by month, over the term. That's apparent when we start to step back and look at the data at a broader scope. But looking at each individual transaction, it's very hard for us to get a sense of whether we're trending up or down. So there may be a reason to be able to do data modeling, to answer questions about what the hidden value of the data is. And this is what really data modeling helps us to understand and helps us to think through. So we want to make sure we're aware of that, really understand that. We obviously have to think about the design of these systems conceptually. What is a database going to be designed like? What kind of access do we have? Is it a relational model? Is it going to be a different kind of database? Are we going to store data outside of databases, just in file share somewhere? Use what's called an enterprise content management system, an ECM system, to get access to it. Think about WebSphere. Think about SharePoint. Think about these kind of systems that allow us to effectively create large electronic filing cabinets, right? And then with a web front end, access the data pretty much on demand whenever we want to see it, provided we authenticate into the system and follow the appropriate usage rules, right? Write program up front, write web-based API to be able to access the data, right level of access or right level of access control, and then we're able to get to the data. So what's the design look like? These are also important questions for us as security professionals to think about. You know, we may not work with databases on a regular basis. We may not be the database manager, in other words, or the DBA, the database administrator or analyst. That doesn't mean we don't have the responsibility to understand that data is stored in places where it needs security, and we have to provide confidentiality, integrity, and availability controls to that data. we may have to partner, in other words, right, and work with a team of individuals that help us to understand the specifics of the technology so that we can better do our job. And database management is a subset of a very important larger conversation around asset management and privacy. But if you don't specialize in database management, then you better specialize in partnering with people that do, is what I often tell my customers and my students, because you're not going to be good at everything. And it's foolish, it's a fallacy to try to get good at everything, because you're just not going to be able to get good enough that you're really going to make a difference at doing it the right way. You're going to do it, but you're probably not going to get it as right as you could, is what I'm suggesting. Specialize in things that you really know how to do well, that you have a passion for, and find the people that specialize in the other things you need that they do well and they have a passion for. Get really good at partnering, and you will get really good at security, in other words, is what I would suggest to you and I want you to think about. So just think about that. How do we look at auditing? We've got data stored, got it in the database, we've classified it, we've categorized it, we've assigned ownership of it, we're using it, but how do we verify what's going on? How do we audit data to ensure that ultimately the use of data is happening along the guidelines that we've set out and stipulated? You know, this is an issue. This is a really big concern. If we can't verify what's happening, we can't know for sure that it's happening the right way. And audits are incredibly important events in the life cycle of data, because audits stipulate and therefore specify what is actually happening as opposed to what we think is happening. So we have the, you know, effectively the 2B situation, right? I'd like to be like that, but audits really help us to understand what we currently are doing, the as is, as opposed to the 2B. And they verify that the as is, the current state, is exactly what we hope it would be. And if it's not, it shows us the deltas or the gaps and points to places where we may need to make some additional fixes or determinations about doing something differently ultimately. You know, audits often are scary words for people, right? We hear auditing and we think, oh my God, somebody's going to come in and tell me I'm doing everything wrong and I'm going to have to start over again. Audits actually don't have to be that. They're not adversarial unless you make them that way. What you need to understand is that the auditor has a job to do, and that auditor is there to figure out what you're supposed to be doing and whether you're doing it the right way. If you already know what you're supposed to do and you're doing it the right way, the auditor is not going to have a lot to do, right? You're going to buy them a cup of coffee. You're going to hang out with them a little bit because they're usually fun people. I know that because I'm an auditor, and look at the cool socks I was wearing when we started. Auditors that wear cool socks like that have to be cool. How else could you possibly interpret that, right? So you're going to buy them a cup of coffee. You're going to talk to them. You're going to let them do their job, get out of their way when they say, I need some time to look at this stuff. But hopefully they're going to come back and tell you, hey, everything is good, because you're exactly in the place you need to be. You're doing the right things. If you're not following procedure, if you're not following policy, if you don't have good documentation, if we ask you where is the policy that stipulates how to do this, and your answer is what's a policy, you're not going to have a good day, right? No matter how much coffee you buy me, you're going to see me look like this. I'm going to be very stern. Not going to look like this. Very happy, right? So when we audit, we want to give you a clean bill of health. But we can only do that legitimately if you're actually doing the job the right way. I mean, that's just the reality of audits. That's what they are. So just be aware of that. Make sure you understand that. Obviously, very important to think about that. You know, finally, as we're wrapping up our conversations in this area, thinking about data access, data sharing, dissemination are also important points when we come to privacy in the conversation about asset management and data privacy overall. When we think about how we're going to access data, are we doing that securely? Are we using secure encrypted communication mechanisms? When we're storing data, are we storing data in encrypted form to prevent it from being compromised? When we are disseminating, we're sharing it broadly and sending it out. Are we doing that via email without any sort of digital signatures, without any sort of encryption so people don't know whether the data is legitimate and know whether it's been secured? You know, when we have a cryptography conversation, one of our upcoming episodes, we'll talk about both symmetric and asymmetric cryptography and the value of using cryptography to secure data, but also to create integrity, non-repudiation and proof of origin for data. When we think about being able to use integrity controls like hashing to do these kind of things, these are important conversations. And this is the kind of thing we have to think about in this area as well, because if we're not focused on those things, if we're not focusing on or thinking about how we access data, how we share it, how we disseminate it, then what's going to happen is somebody's going to come and access it in a way they're not supposed to, or they're going to take it away from us, and or when we have data that's in the system, and we think we're securing it. What about the data that's left behind when we destroy the data, when we get rid of it at the end of the data life cycle? What about data remnants? You know, we've talked about residual risk before, risk that's left over. Data gets left over as well. This is another important element of the conversation here. Data remnants is data that's left over when we destroy the data in the system through, you know, accepted methods. We overwrite the data, we degauss the drive, whatever we may do. There's always something left behind. The question is whether we can actually get to the data and reconstitute it or not. And this is also part of the data privacy and data auditing conversation. Destroying media and getting rid of the data that is there in a standard or certified way to ensure the data is not exposed. We don't breach confidentiality, we don't breach integrity, but we do safeguard the data destruction process is incredibly important for the security professional. We've talked about what gets left behind. We've talked about some of the ways you can do that. Make sure you're aware of all these things, all the encompassing points of the conversation we've had with regards to privacy.
Very good, Adam. It's a great look at privacy and, you know, how to protect that data, that information, make sure it's kept secure again. Another one of those throughout its life cycle, right? From when that data was created to when it's stored, maintained, accessed, as well as in the end of its lifetime when we have to get rid of that data. Also a little insightful look into the world of auditors and how to keep them happy and make sure your auditor now do, you know, make sure you're doing it right and get them coffee and you should be
and compliment them on their socks. It's also very important.
Absolutely. Make sure you look at their socks. All right, Adam, we appreciate all that. We hope everybody enjoyed watching. Remember, if you want to attend one of Adam's classes live, all you gotta do is drop us an email at cadam@itpro.tv. That's going to do it for this episode. Signing out, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.